Hello, my name's Christian Johnson and welcome to Leeds Live's special podcast series, The Case of the Cranstons. Over the next three episodes, my colleagues and I will be exploring all the details of a case that shocked the city of Leeds and people across the country. I am, of course, referring to the case of Jordan Burling, an 18-year-old who was allowed to rot to death in his family home in Farnley back in June 2016. When paramedics found him, he weighed less than 6 stone. He was severely malnourished and dehydrated, covered in infected pressure sores and wearing a soiled nappy. He went into cardiac arrest and died shortly after they arrived. His awful condition was later likened to that of a concentration camp prisoner from the Second World War, and after Jordan's death, police searched the family home to find the decomposed remains of a baby inside a rucksack in one of the bedroom wardrobes. On the 12th of July this year, his mother Dawn Cranston and grandmother Denise Cranston were jailed after being convicted of his manslaughter at Leeds Crown Court by a unanimous jury. His sister Abigail Burling was cleared of manslaughter at the same trial, but jailed for an alternative charge of causing or allowing the death of a vulnerable adult. In the coming episodes, we'll be taking a close look at Jordan's dramatic deterioration, his family's inadequate attempts to care for him, the reasons why they didn't call for medical assistance, and Dawn's explanation for the skeleton in her closet. We'll also be discussing the evidence given by medical experts, psychologists, and the defendants, the sentencing itself, and all of the reaction since. But today we'll start by looking at Jordan, his family, and the traumatic events which made them withdraw from the outside world and create a bubble for themselves. Now, in episode one, I'm joined by Nathan. Hello, Nathan. Tell us a little bit what it was like from a personal perspective to cover this, because it was so horrific, wasn't it?
Yeah, obviously it was a lengthy trial. It went on for about 5 weeks. I know you are and Stephanie Finnegan were all in there covering it, and just like so many people, you know, that it's been really shocked and disturbed by all of the details, everyone from the paramedics and try and save this poor boy's life to the police who've investigated the case, to, you know, the jurors who had to go through all the details of this and people who've read about it. I know people are really sort of shocked and disturbed. I think there are three things that make this case particularly shocking. First of all, just how extreme his condition was. I know there was a bone pathologist who stood up and he said he'd never seen a case of malnutrition like this in this country.
Well, it's that comment as well, isn't it, about looking like a concentration camp prisoner. Yeah. I mean, that speaks volumes about the state that he was in.
Yeah, exactly. You'd never expect anything like this to happen in a first world country, let alone in a quiet neighbourhood in the corner of Leeds like so many of us live in. Secondly, obviously the fact that it's his mum, his grandma and his sister have all been jailed for their parts in his death. You know, these are the three people he trusted most in the world. He relied on them and he should have been able to trust them, but ultimately wasn't able to. And I think one for me that really sort of made this shocking was the fact that he wasn't, you know, hidden away. He wasn't locked in some downstairs, under the stairs. He wasn't, you know, hidden in some bedroom at the back of the house. He was in front and centre in the living room and the focal point of the house. They came in contact with him every single day, you know, and he was literally deteriorating in front of their eyes and they didn't pick up the phone and take a very simple step to help him.
And that deterioration reached such terrible, terrible sort of lengths at the end. But we'll start by talking about Jordan and what he was like as a boy, becoming a teenager and eventually, tragically, when he died when he was 18. But as a young lad, we'll go back right back to the very start. And the first sort of snapshot we got of him in this trial in court was when some family liaison officers went round to the family home shortly before Jordan's birthday in 2001, and that's because Abigail, his older sister, had a poor attendance at school. Now, these guys went into the family home and they said they didn't actually know about Jordan. Yeah. Before they went into the family home, it wasn't something that was known to the school that Abigail had a younger brother. Tell us a little bit about what it was like when they walked in, because they were incredibly shocked, weren't they, when they walked into the home?
Yeah, so we heard in court it was a learning mentor called Karen Tiffany and her colleague Sandra Pearce, and they made an unannounced visit to the house. Firstly, Dawn didn't want to let them in, and one of them actually had to put their foot in the door. And they've obviously gone into the house, they've seen Jordan's on the floor in a soiled nappy. You know, the house is quite dirty and cluttered. There's black mould up the walls. I think they said his nappy was, you know, really heavy, and they weren't impressed with what they found. I think what was the comment they used?
The quote that I've just got up here is, it was one of the worst houses I'd been into at the time. There was, like you say, mould, black mould 2 feet up the walls, an awful smell, mouldy bread on the floor. Shows the sort of conditions that Jordan was in from a very young age, and, you know, alarm bells were ringing at that stage. But that shows that Jordan, even as a toddler, was not being cared for adequately.
It's fair to say he didn't have the easiest life or the best upbringing. And then you sort of move on, he goes to school. And again, we heard in court that there was a report that said there was a general neglect of the child's basic needs. You know, his teeth were black. He wasn't toilet trained. They even said that his shoes were several sizes too big, and that they're actually stuffing socks into the front of his shoes. You know, personally, I find that really sad, and it must have been incredibly difficult. We all know how difficult school can be, even if you have a decent upbringing and a lot of support. So for him, that must have been, you know, quite traumatic to go through that.
Even before that, though, even before he's a toddler, even before he was born, the family weren't properly looking after him during the pregnancy, because Dawn didn't know until the day before that she went into labour that Jordan was even, you know, existed. That's literally the state we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think they try and hinted that during the trial that may have been not an excuse, but one of the reasons why, you know, she wasn't very well prepared to take care of this child. But yeah, very difficult upbringing, really difficult life. And then it doesn't get much easier for him as he moves on. He goes to Farnley Park High School, where he was bullied. They didn't exactly go into the reasons why, but I'm sure you can imagine, you know, why he may have struggled to get on with other people from the school. And his mother actually wrote to the council and took him out of the school after 2 terms, and said he's going to be homeschooled.
So he was then schooled at home from pretty much as soon as he went into secondary school. Now, it must be said that, you know, there are pictures of Jordan long before he died, but he, you know, wearing glasses, and he looked, if anything, a little bit chubby. You know, he wasn't really skinny like he was at the end. He wasn't malnutrition like he was right just before his death. He was described as chatty and bubbly. He supposedly liked football. He liked WWE, like his sister Abigail, and we'll come on to talk about that a little bit later. And he liked video games and DVDs. Interesting quote, though, is again, we'll come on to this in more detail later on in this podcast series, but when he became 18, he apparently described himself as the man of the house, didn't he?
Yeah, so they said, interestingly, they said when he was a kid, when Denise was given evidence in court, they said he was a bit of a hypochondriac, and it became kind of a family joke and things like that. And but anyway, sort of, once he turned 18, it was repeatedly said during the trial that he described himself as the man of the house. He became increasingly stubborn, and it was difficult to tell him things or to try and change his mind about anything. That was something that Denise and Dawn repeatedly said at the trial. Just something like the prosecution said that, you know, after he was taken out of school, he never attended school or college again, never took any examinations or achieved any qualifications, nor did he ever work, as far as it can be ascertained. He said, from the time Jordan was taken out of school, he became increasingly anonymous. Education and social services played little part in his life. So, you know, I think that's that kind of explains how almost that no one from the outside world realised what was going on, and how he was deteriorating over, it was around about 6 months. You know, and you'd like to think if you or I went missing for 6 months, someone would, you know, notice, or, you know, even put in a phone call or ask around, say, have you seen them? I think that's really one of the saddest parts of this case.
100%. And the only people who were around to notice that he disappeared from school and everything else were the three women in the home. And let's come on to talk about those women now, the first of whom, Dawn Cranston. So that's Jordan's mum. Tell us a little bit about Dawn then, her upbringing and what was said during the trial about Dawn.
Yeah, so I know, obviously, if you read the headlines about this case, and you take a glance at it, it's easy to look at Dawn and Denise especially as monsters, you know, how could they let this happen? But during the trial we heard at length about how they both had quite difficult lives, and starting with Dawn, you know, again, she didn't have the easiest upbringing. They said she was bullied at school, you know, quite severely. She lived with her father, Herbert Cranston, who we'll go and speak a little bit more about, who was described as very controlling. He was known to lash out. You know, it sounds like it was quite, it was like treading on eggshells in that house.
Not the easiest upbringing, to say the least.
No, and then when she was 14, there was a very traumatic incident that she suffered, and apparently she reported it to the school. The school did nothing.
And this was all said in the trial, wasn't it?
Yeah, so obviously a difficult life. The interesting thing about that traumatic event, so we heard evidence from Dr. Van Velsen, who is a forensic psychiatrist, and she said that, in her opinion, this traumatic event triggered dissociative disorders that are characterised by depersonalisation and derealisation. And that was one of the sort of big mitigating factors in the case. So she said, you know, when she interviewed Dawn, Dawn said, you know, sometimes it was like her surroundings were a bit dreamlike or hazy, and it was almost like she was looking through a pane of glass. And that was something that helped Dr. Van Velsen come to this conclusion. The way she described it is she's kind of just... it's a pathological condition that caused her to become detached from reality.
And a lack of emotion was something that really came through, wasn't it, in this assessment?
Yeah, and there are two things. I think they were the biggest mitigating factors in Dawn's case as to why, you know, she sees her son wasting away in front of her eyes, and she can't adequately respond to what's happening. So the way the psychiatrist explained it was almost like, if you're a paramedic or a police officer and you go to, you know, a really bad accident where there's it's particularly gruesome, you have to detach yourself so you can deal with that in a professional way. But for some people, people like Dawn, it's a problem, it's pathological, so they don't intentionally detach themselves from it. It just happens. So anyway, sort of moving on as well, Dawn is she has a relationship with a man called Stephen Burling, who's Jordan's father and Abigail's father, meets him when she's about 18, and they live together, and then they get evicted and they split up early in the 2000s. It's around about 2002, and Dawn goes back to live with her mother, Denise, and her father, Herbert Cranston, in this house. And so shortly after that as well, the family become targeted by... they were described as youths in the courts. We don't know exactly how old they are or why.
But the family was targeted by people in the area, and yeah, because they were seen as being a little bit odd.
I think so, yeah. So,
eggs were thrown at the house. It wasn't a pleasant experience for the family.
Yeah, and it wasn't just, you know, some random events where it was a few eggs. It was apparently, it's quite prolonged, and it got severe, and this caused Herbert's mental health to deteriorate. Apparently he wasn't a very well man anyway, and that he was struggling, but this one, you know, really sort of pushed him over the edge. And unfortunately, in 2006 he actually took his own life and hung himself in one of the upstairs bedrooms, and that, you know, that's another thing was really mentioned when during mitigation, when they were trying to sort of explain, you know, one of the many reasons why Dawn was struggling mentally. And, you know, since 2006, she said she was suffering from depression and anxiety, and she gave evidence, I think it was over 2 days, and what was very clear is, you know, when things got particularly tough, whether it was with Jordan or the baby, the baby she had, and then obviously hid in the closet, that she would say, you know, I started to panic, I shut down. That was a term she kept using. So yeah, I mean, whether she did or not, you know, that's, we'll never really know, to be honest, but this was what she kept saying.
And alarm bells were ringing. Obviously, we mentioned earlier she was unaware that she was pregnant with Jordan until the day before she gave birth to him. That's obviously not the only shocking sort of birth story that is not the most by any stretch. She also gave birth to what she says was a baby boy in the family home, She didn't tell anyone about it. And she said that the baby was dead when she gave birth to it, but yeah. It was later found by officers when they discovered Jordan, stuffed in a rucksack over 10 years later. And they're the details. Again, we'll come on to them in a bit more closer inspection later. But that says that Dawn emotionally couldn't quite process things that yeah. most normal people could.
Yeah, so, I mean, she was grilled at length about the baby, obviously. And it's important to say that she was charged with concealing the birth of a child, so she wasn't charged with murder or anything like that. But her story is she doesn't realise she's pregnant, goes into labour. It's quite a quick labour, she says. She gives birth and it's a stillbirth, and delivers the baby and the placenta on the floor of her bedroom while her family members are in the house.
In the house at the time.
So mother and father are downstairs. Her brother Carl, who we'll talk about more, you know, later on, they're all in the house, and he, you know, he was asked repeatedly why she didn't shout for help. She said things like, "Oh, the TV was on. You can't hear people from upstairs when the TV's on," and really sort of strange things like that. And so she gives birth to this baby. She says she does checks to see if the baby's breathing. You know, listens for breaths, tries to feel for a pulse, these sort of things, and then panics and sort of shuts down. And instead of, you know, crying out for help or anything like that, she stuffs the baby into several plastic bags and then puts those plastic bags into a rucksack and puts it up into a wardrobe. She says she checked on it shortly after that, maybe around an hour or so, she wasn't clear. And then that poor baby boy's body remained there for about 14 years. It wasn't sort of totally clear. And obviously when police found it, they said it was just a rancid smelling liquid, some teeth and bones, which is just... it's absolutely horrifying.
It's so hard to sort of come to terms with that. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will have followed our live blog, which we covered extensively at the time of the trial. There's the information there in episode 2 of this 3-part series as well. We'll talk a little bit more about what was found in the house once they'd attended to Jordan and sadly found out that he'd died as well. So that's Dawn, that's Jordan's mum. Denise played a big part as well in Jordan's upbringing. Yeah. That was Jordan's grandma again. What do we know about her?
So it's important to say that the judge, when sentencing the woman, he said, you know, Dawn was the most culpable, but Denise was also sort of highly culpable, hence why, you know, they were both done for manslaughter. But again, Denise is not someone who's had a particularly easy life, and the judge took that on board when he sentenced her. She was married to Herbert Cranston for, I think it was 37 years, so just under 40 years. And he was, like I've said before, he was described as controlling. Apparently, he didn't like Denise to show any emotion in front of her. He wouldn't let her cry. And, you know, it sounded like he was an incredibly difficult person to live with, and especially to be married to. And they took that on board. They also, again in the trial, we heard evidence from Dr. Wood, a consultant and clinical forensic psychologist. And two of his most interesting findings were, firstly, he said, Denise has a very, very low IQ. She's in the bottom 10% for everyone who sort of does an IQ test. And secondly, she's found to be highly compliant. So she will, in his opinion, he said she will go along with things even if she doesn't agree with them. And that was, they tried to sort of give that as an explanation as to why she would go along with Jordan, with Denise's decision not to call a doctor or anyone else's decision. But, and you know, she repeatedly said when they were asked why didn't you call for help that Jordan didn't want it,
and that was said repeatedly throughout, not just from Denise, yeah. but from Dawn, from Abigail. That you know, it was said that it was Jordan's decision. That's what the three of them said. Jordan's yeah. decision. He didn't want a doctor there, but clearly he needed a doctor there. And Denise said that when they saw his terrible wounds that he had, that the pressure sore, they said the family used to call it gristle.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, the details will come into later, and just be warned, they are very, very graphic, the details that we'll be coming on to. But to call it gristle and then to refuse medical assistance just seems yeah. bizarre, doesn't it? And but go on, because you were going to say a bit more about this this assessment.
Yeah, so, you know, that seems to, in this guy's opinion, that would kind of go some way to explain her behaviour, that she wouldn't, you know, like she would be compliant with whatever her husband said for nearly 4 decades, that she'd also be compliant with what her grandson was saying when he was being stubborn and refusing to get help. However, the judge didn't totally buy into this, which is quite interesting. And, you know, when he sentenced it, he actually said, having seen you in the witness box for 2 days, I'm quite satisfied you were able to understand the need to get Jordan urgent medical help. So, you know, on his assessment, from having seen her and watched her give evidence and watched her respond to questions, while she may not exactly be the brightest person, you know, she's also is able to understand and respond to situations like this. And she was also described in court as quite a dominant presence in the family home. So this kind of, you know, contradicts what this forensic psychologist said.
Contradicts the compliancy, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, what you've got on one hand, you've got this expert saying that she's really complying. And then in another aspect, it was the judge who actually used that term, saying, you know, you're a dominant presence, you know, you're a leading figure. And it was also said that Dawn respected you and she often went to you for advice and things like that. So it's not as if she's, you know, she can't make her own decisions or anything like that. And yeah, clearly a leading figure in the house. So it is quite interesting, but also slightly contradictory, you know, what we heard.
We'll go on to the third of the three women in the house, and that's Abigail Burling, the older sister of Jordan. Now, interestingly, she didn't give any evidence in her defence. One thing she did say in initial police interviews very soon after Jordan was found dead, she refused to answer any questions. The only one that she did answer was to say that Jordan had been playing football the night before he died. Now, clearly, this can't have been the case. He couldn't move. He had no energy. He hadn't been fed.
He didn't have any muscle in his legs.
Abigail's a really intriguing character in this because she's the closest, arguably, to Jordan because she was his sister, closest to his age. They seem quite close as kids. They got similar interests.
Yeah, and they, you know, it said many times that they shared interests. They're both massive WWE fans. Apparently, they were, even when Jordan became quite ill, they were looking to go and watch a WWE event and things like that. And they did share interests and they go into town together and things like that. And it's, you know, it wasn't like they hated each other and they never spoke. They were friends. They weren't just brother and sister. She's a strange character. And like I said, we didn't hear nearly as much about her as the other two. Especially her decision not to give any evidence strikes me as strange, really strange. And obviously they were asked, you know, do you realise the possible implications of this? And she still just decided to say nothing. But, I mean, she was described as leading an aimless life. I know she was a full-time mother. Sadly, her daughter's been taken into care, obviously, since these criminal proceedings started. But, you know, she was a mum and she obviously cared for her child, but it doesn't seem like, you know, she was particularly ambitious or had a lot else going on. And yeah, like you said, there were certain things that the police, that she said during the police interviews, that turned out to be false. Obviously that Jordan was playing football the day before, and it was also said that, I think one thing she said, she wasn't really around the house that often, and that she was, you know, so that could maybe be an excuse because she might not have seen this. And I think it was through mobile phone.
That's right, she wasn't, she had an address elsewhere. She supposedly lived there, but a number of times when people went to visit her to check up on her daughter, she was seen coming back from Dawn and Denise's home, her family home where she grew up. She was seen coming back from there, so it was suspected that she spent very little time at her own home and spent a lot of time with Dawn, with Denise and with Jordan. So she clearly did see Jordan's deterioration firsthand, very, very closely. She was also quite a prolific tweeter, and she tweeted right up until she was sent to jail. You know, she tweeted about WWE most of the time, but she tweeted consistently throughout the trial, which a lot of people may seem as a little bit odd. And on July the 8th, so just a few days before she was sentenced, she said, the past two nights I've been having the same flashback and it's affecting my anxiety disorder. I feel like deleting everything and leaving. So clearly she toyed with the emotional aspect of it, but perhaps struggled to convey quite what she felt in those police interviews and in the fact that she didn't give any evidence.
And also interestingly, it was said that while, so we heard from experts that Denise Cranston had a particularly low IQ, it was also said, missed this out earlier, that Dawn had, you know, slightly lower IQ, but it wasn't, you know, as low as her mother, Denise's. But Abigail had average intelligence. You know, she wasn't someone that, well, we didn't hear that she struggled with any sort of learning disabilities or, you know, anything like that. So she was, you know, you may even be able to argue that she was best placed and best equipped to respond to this. But while we didn't hear any, she didn't give any evidence in her defence, we did, a barrister did stand up and outline mitigating circumstances, and he actually asked for a suspended sentence. And the judge obviously overlooked that and refused. But, you know, we heard that she'd obviously lost her child who'd been taken into care. Apparently she'd also tried to move back into the family home, and people living nearby had read about the case, been following the case, and they'd sort of forced her out, asked her to leave. They said she was also, you know, very reliant on her mother and grandmother, and she'll obviously lose that if they go to prison, things like that. So we heard a lot about how it's affected her, but we didn't, it didn't really go much into why she didn't necessarily respond, you know, when things started to go downhill quite dramatically. I think even there was one bit where I think it was Denise texted her and asked her if she had any sanitary pads, because that's what they were using to, you know, they were actually putting them over Jordan's infected pressure sores. And, you know, surely to most people, to the vast majority of people, that sends the alarm bells ringing, doesn't it? That
should It really should.
Red flag. And even, you know, even if you weren't, even if her, she was telling the truth when she said she wasn't around all the time, you'd think she'd be becoming very concerned about her brother and not seeing him regularly, or, you know, even when you get a strange text like that from your mother. But again,
One more person to talk about just before we wrap up this episode then, and this is Carl. Do you want to tell us who Carl is? He didn't play as big a part in this, but just to complete this family picture.
Yeah, so Carl also lived in the house. He's Denise's severely autistic son, so he would be Dawn's brother. Apparently Dawn and Denise cared for him, and they, you know, we heard during the trial that they did a fairly good job of it. And that, you know, he wasn't neglected or mistreated, and what he was able to communicate with the people who interviewed him and stuff like that. And they said, you know, he wasn't suffering. But it was also then later said that he's actually been taken into care, I assume by the local authority, since criminal proceedings begun. And he's was said to be thriving without his family. So hopefully, you know, he is doing well. But I mean, just so that's obviously the everyone, all of the individuals who live in the family, but, you know, as a family unit, one of the neighbours described them as strange and reclusive, you know, and I think there were a few people said that they were sort of withdrawn, especially since this attack with eggs and stones and things like that, and that may be another reason why they didn't turn for help from the outside world, you know.
In a strange way, they're almost quite a close-knit family. It sounds like a bizarre thing to say considering everything that's gone on, but clearly Dawn, Denise and Abigail were the three of them were quite close together, and they didn't have that many contacts outside of the family home.
Yeah, so going back to Dr. Van Velsen, who you know, assessed Dawn, she actually said that she's created, I think it's she used the term like a psychic cave, you know, a retreat, because she's been hurt, because she's gone through these traumatic events. You know, her and her family have withdrawn from the outside world, and, you know, that's not a particularly strange reaction, is it? You know, a lot of people, if you get hurt or something, you resort back to what you know best and what's familiar, and there's nothing more familiar than the family. But it's quite clear, as a family unit, they were, the judge actually described them as eccentric, dysfunctional and close-knit, which I think was very apt. So, you know, they were kind of hinting that was one of the reasons why, again, they didn't go to outsiders for help. I think Denise said, you know, he's family. And that was something she said several times. So we take care of family, we take care of our own. Obviously, they weren't doing an adequate job because, you know, he suffered for quite a while and died.
But they believe they were doing that.
Yeah, and it's at one point that Dr. Van Velsen said, you know, I think it was maybe a month or two before Jordan died, but it was in the lead-up to his death, and she actually took a photo of Jordan to show him how skinny he was, and we've seen the photos. West Yorkshire Police actually released him. He is, you know,
he's in a terrible state.
If any outsider took one look at him, they would, yeah, you'd think to call paramedics straight away. He's clearly very malnourished, and they said, you know, his weight fluctuated through his teenage years, like it does with a lot of people. However, he's gone from this sort of chubby little boy to someone you can see his ribs, and she takes this photo of him, you know, and Dr. Van Velsen says she sees it because she, and she says she wants to show it to him to try and convince him, but again, she doesn't do anything.
It's almost convincing herself that she needs to do.
Yes, because she thinks she's a good mother, and she thinks she's caring for him, you know, as she has done all of her life. But you know, even that doesn't trigger. So she kind of knows something's wrong, but it doesn't force her. And it's not something she needed to do that was particularly complicated either. She just had to pick up the phone, you know, and
dial 999.
And obviously, when she did, as we'll come and go into more in the next episode, when she did, it was far too late.
Well, thanks for sticking with us for episode one in the Case of the Cranstons podcast series. In episode two, Nathan and I will be joined by Steph Finnegan, Leeds Live's court reporter, to discuss just how Jordan was allowed to deteriorate to such an extent that he weighed 6 stone. Why didn't the family call the emergency services? Did Jordan really refuse help from doctors? And also, what happened with that baby found in the bedroom? We'll see you next time.